Browning 50 cal. That was awesome. Whenever you read the comments on a local news article about crime, in which every other response is a guy fantasizing about burying hip-hop thugs up to their necks and driving a John Deere over them, you're taking part in the conservative style pioneered by Mr. Kersey. Fred Flintstone. In the conservative worldview, the anchor of society is a strong father figure. All good things flow from a strong family unit, and you can't have one of those without a man who pays the bills and lays down the law. As the prototypical blue-collar guy in Paterfamilias, Fred Flintstone was one of the first models of fatherly virtue. Fred was a lover of simple things. Rock bowling, driving his rock car, drinking rock beer, and killing pterodactyls for fun. Untainted by postmodern influences, Fred showed that things were better when the man was the head of the house. He belonged to fraternal organizations like the Water Buffalo Lodge and the John Bauxite Society, which encouraged civil leadership and homogeneous communities. Fred always insisted on ordering as many brontosaurus ribs as he wanted, regardless of Mayor Rockberg's whining that it was too much and would tip the car over. Fred created an intellectual justification for wishing you lived in the distant past that conservatives have been cribbing from ever since. William F. Buckley, Jr. The true godfather of modern conservatism, William Francis Buckley, Jr., did more to advance the intellectual case for conservative principles than anyone else in the latter half of the 20th century. He did all this despite being technically dead since the late 70s. As a writer, thinker, and social gadfly, Buckley remains an iconic figure on the right. He's still regarded as a great mind because he affected a tough accent and was on television a lot. He remains so beloved that even his darting, Gila monster-like eyes and tongue are often described by writers even worse than he was as energetic or possessing a certain twinkle. This impressive appearance made him a memorable party guest and a formidable opponent of civil rights. Not much is known about Buckley's early life. He first appears as a member of Yale's Skull and Bone Society, where he quickly rose to prominence by spending the longest time ever jacking off in a coffin. "I feel quite at home in here, Ducky," he was once quoted as saying during a particularly successful initiation rite. Buckley's name does crop up again in the public record during his 2 years working as a professional snitch for the CIA in the 50s. However, it has long been speculated that he was a guinea pig in the agency's infamous Operation Fauntleroy, a Cold War-era mind control program designed to create the most insufferably precious fancy lad of all time. After emerging as a fully formed dandy from the Ivies and the agency, Buckley got his start in politics as a lickspittle for Joe McCarthy and would go on to lend his name and every cliche he could muster to virtually every crackpot right-wing movement or group in America and every blood-drenched dictatorship overseas. He did this as the founder of the premier journal of conservative thought, the National Review, for which he penned classic lines such as, "The white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail over black people because it is the advanced race." And, "Everyone detected with AIDS should be tattooed in the upper forearm to protect common needle users and on the buttocks to prevent the victimization of other homosexuals." And something to the effect of, "I was dead wrong about apartheid in the American South back then, but am correct about apartheid in South Africa now." In both life and death, Buckley is often positioned against his great nemesis, Gore Vidal, whom he famously called a queer on national television. The clash of these two titans of the left and right makes for an interesting contrast. On one hand, you have Vidal, who produced a major body of work, including dozens of novels and plays, and hundreds of essays touching on every aspect of American history, literature, and politics. On the other, You have Buckley, who wrote a book about how there are too many Jews at Yale, a few lyrical essays about how much he loved sailing, and a series of spy novels in which a thinly veiled alter ego named Blackford Oakes fucks the Queen of England. Vidal and Buckley's famous spat on television is also funny because it involves Buckley calling Vidal a homo and then threatening to beat him up in the gayest way possible. Buckley died around 1977, but his shambling cadaver maintained a bizarre form of unlife until 2008, robotically churning out columns, making TV appearances, and taking young men sailing. His influence on the American right is still deeply felt. While many people believe Buckley defined the parameters of the modern right wing, his really lasting contribution is the creation of a pretentious writing style aped by every single slob, moron, and dork to come out of a college Republican group and land bylines in Buckley's characteristically undead magazine. Murray Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe. One of the many ways in which libertarianism is like Scientology is that both organizations try to ease new recruits in. Scientologists don't bring up Xenu and volcanoes full of dead aliens until one has already signed the trillion-year contract. They start with e-meters and diet tips. Similarly, when libertarians make their pitch to skeptical youth, they tend to emphasize the common sense, economics 101 writings of Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek. Capitalism is just choice. Everybody loves choice, right? It's only later, after one has hosted an awkward campaign fundraiser for Bob Barr and named one's firstborn Bitcoin, that they offer up the hard stuff. Murray Rothbard and Hans Hermann Hoppe took the fuzzy, freedom-loving logic of libertarianism to its logical endpoint, a place that most of the uninitiated would consider a nightmare of inhumanity. Rothbard, who didn't leave the island of Manhattan until his 40s due to an intense fear of bridges and tunnels, realized that a political system based on property had a child problem. Children don't own property and they don't work. So what is the basis for their claim to rights? His answer was, they don't have one. Children are the property of their parents, who can dispose of them as they wish. They can't kill them, of course. That would violate the non-aggression principle. But they could starve them to death, or, if they're angling for a trip to Branson, sell them. For his part, Hoppe reached the conclusion, inescapable but unspoken by most mainstream libertarians, that democracy is incompatible with liberty. Property is the basis for freedom, so society is, obviously, a mutual agreement among property owners. All functions of the state should be privatized. What about people who don't own property? Asks the nerd. They don't have rights, bitch, answers Hoppe. Hoppe argued that the most natural form of government was feudal aristocracy, and that the imposition of the taxation and redistribution associated with liberal democracy was in fact far worse than the serfdom of an earlier era. Hoppe's biggest idea was that because democracy is majoritarian by nature, the majority of people will choose to be protected from oppression and discrimination. This, to Hoppe, was why democracy is a terrible evil that must be abolished and replaced with a system of unfettered private tyrannies. Often, libertarians will couch their arguments in terms of personal freedom and sell them based on the idea that if we only would abolish the capital gains tax, the EPA, and public schools, we would all be much freer to be you and me. Once big government is out of the way, we can all smoke weed and fuck whatever our 3D printers can dream up, so the argument goes. But, for some reason, serious libertarians like Hoppe don't cotton to the notion that their politics are about expanding the personal freedom of other people, particularly young people and racial and sexual minorities. Hoppe correctly realized that the total abolition of the state in favor of a strict regime of private property and laissez-faire economics would involve the brutal curtailment of the freedoms of speech, movement, and bodily autonomy for the vast majority of people. And that was a good thing. He envisioned a society managed by a combination of large landowners, homeowners associations, and insurance companies that would enforce the property rights of their customers and no one else's. What's more, Hoppe also realized that this society would necessarily involve the forced expulsion of anyone who thought differently. According to Hoppe, there can be no tolerance towards Democrats and communists in a libertarian social order. They will have to be physically separated and expelled from society. Likewise, in a covenant founded for the purpose of protecting family and kin, there can be no tolerance towards those habitually promoting lifestyles incompatible with this goal. They, the advocates of alternative, non-family and kin-centered lifestyles, such as, for instance, individual hedonism, parasitism, nature-environment worship, homosexuality, or communism, will have to be physically removed from society too, if one is to maintain a libertarian order. This is the kind of stuff that would send a normie running for the hills, but once you've bought your third Penn Jillette book, you're pot committed. If any intellectual has laid the groundwork for where the right is headed now, it's Hoppe. Scorched earth libertarianism fueled by atavistic hatred of minorities, queers, and communists. Now, let's depart from the mind castles of these great figures and witness modern conservatism in practice.
We are openly 100% evil, conservatives throughout American history. There was a time in the country when men were truly free, when rugged individuals could carve out and tame a piece of the American wilderness, build a home, buy some seed and some workers, and wring wealth from the black earth. A man's plantation was his castle. A man's wife was his lady. A man's slaves were his property. A man's hat was, I don't know, his daughter. The government existed to protect him from foreign invaders and domestic cutthroats, but otherwise had no power to interfere with his life and works. A man would wake up, spend the morning reading on his veranda, being fanned by one of his cheerful thralls, ride his horse through his gorgeous fields of cotton and indigo, shoot anything that flew, walked, or crawled on his property, and have the cook serve it up to him at a sumptuous dinner. This was the real land of liberty. Then, under a dark cloud, the bleeding-heart do-gooders of the nanny state invaded and ruined everything with their freedom-stifling bureaucracy and so-called 13th Amendment, just because some visionary liberty lovers banded together to secede from the Union to expand human slavery. Nothing to fear but equality itself. But the arc of history bends towards justice. Thankfully, the economics of war created opportunities for capital accumulation beyond the dreams of even the most successful antebellum agribusiness entrepreneur, creating a new class of free men, the slanderously named robber barons. These business titans used their massive wealth to push the boundaries of what freedom could mean. Yachts as big as mansions, mansions as big as hippodromes, days filled with oysters, champagne, and showgirls. You could hire Pinkertons to murder Irishmen, name libraries and concert halls after yourself, and get gout. Then, once again, big government pencil pushers, jealous of the robber barons' hashtag success win lifestyles, destroyed their freedom with a so-called New Deal. All just because unfettered capitalist speculation had destroyed the world's economy. This is how freedom dies, to thunderous applause. After that, entire generations were lost, hooked and abused by the foul regulatory regime of FDR's shock troops. Gender and racial caste systems were thankfully maintained, but the laissez-faire freedom of the wild 19th century was replaced by a stultifying order of high taxes, strong unions, and restrained innovation. All because a solid majority of American voters came out of the Great Depression convinced that capitalism needed to be tightly controlled by government oversight. Cowards. So the nation's achievers and visionaries spent decades in the wilderness, scheming and theorizing about how to get regular schmoes to recognize that untrammeled economic liberty was in their best interests. Captains of industry spent the 1950s exchanging samizdat by the aforementioned subversive libertarian thinkers Ayn Rand, Friedrich Hayek, Count Chocula, and others. They spent money to build an intellectual and media infrastructure that would take their message to the people. By the early 1960s, they were ready to unveil a new, vigorous conservatism to replace the stuffy country club republicanism of years past. A bold defense of economic and personal liberty, a muscular military, down with government meddling, from zoning regulations to taxes to civil rights laws. These appeals found a ready audience among not only the white Southerners who had been diaping out since Brown versus Board of Education, but also the new generation of suburban strivers. These PUDs had grown fat and happy in the Keynesian hothouse of the 1950s and yearned for a freakier, more daring capitalism that would give them the status of true gods, a world where they would break the shackles of regulation, where merciless competition would see the best and strongest rewarded for their power, where communism would be vanquished, not appeased, and where uppity minorities would truly learn their place again. An army of suburban warriors, fired up by this activist reactionaryism, stormed the GOP and nominated Arizona Senator and human Lego Barry Goldwater for the presidency in 1964. But most voters at the time still believed that the media was an impartial arbiter of truth rather than a cultural Marxist brainwashing machine, so when the paper said Goldwater was a dangerous extremist, folks believed them. Goldwater got crushed, and liberals got the Great Society. The Silent But Deadly Majority. Sicko libs didn't have too long to gloat, however. The 1960s saw the inherent and irreconcilable contradictions of liberal society explode into open conflict. The civil rights movement, the war in Vietnam, and a generalized youth culture revolt saw many more middle-class white people coming around to the Goldwaterite analysis of America. It had gone soft. It coddled criminal minorities and communists here and abroad. The times demanded a return to hierarchy and control. And if that meant sabotaging the burgeoning welfare state, then so be it. Richard Nixon took this reactionary discontent and made it respectable and mainstream. No one could accuse old Dick Nixon of being a fringe crank like Goldwater. His command of the issues and connections to establishment conservatism were unsurpassed. Nixon rode a wave of disenchantment and media acquiescence to a narrow victory in 1968, but paradigm shifts take time. He had to deal with a Congress dominated by New Dealers, and was forced to govern from the center-left on domestic policy. But in the arena of culture, Nixon stoked social conflict and positioned himself as the tribune of the little guy, the silent majority, the hardhat who had been shouted down and bullied by agitating minorities and smart-mouthed student brats. The taciturn bigots helped Nixon roll to a historic blowout win over George Acid Amnesty Abortion Adult Baby McGovern. Yet Nixon's project was undone by the Watergate scandal, in which he sent spies to bug Democratic National Committee headquarters in order to find out whether Jane Fonda liked him or, you know, liked him, which gave the foundering Democrats a new grip on power. Jimmy Carter came into office with Republicans fully discredited by Watergate and Democrats in control of both houses of Congress, just in time to oversee the dismantling of the New Deal policy consensus. Rising foreign competition to American industry, skyrocketing energy prices, galloping inflation, and cost overruns on NASA's $6 million man project caused a crisis for capitalism in the 1970s. Rates of profit collapsed, and firms felt they could no longer afford the post-war deal they had made with workers for union recognition and high wages in exchange for labor peace. With the ruling class unwilling to budge on their monocle allowances, profits would have to be maintained at the expense of labor. So Carter carried out a policy of high interest rates and deregulation that helped the 1% get their libertarian revolution without even having to win any elections. It's all for you, Jody Foster. By the time Ronald Reagan successfully snared the Republican nomination for president in 1980, the stage was set for a politics of pure reactionary cultural grievance. Neoliberal reform of the economy had been implemented without much in the way of public debate or voter input. Reagan's campaign took this right-wing economic reality and ran with it, promising an unfettered capitalism that would work to reinstitute the hierarchical social relations of pre-1960s America. But a strange thing happened over the next few decades. The economy became markedly more savage and immiserating. Income stayed flat or declined as productivity rose and CEO pay exploded. Deindustrialization obliterated entire swaths of the country, and stable middle-class jobs were replaced by precarious part-time service industry ones. All the while, the cultural drift that had originally alienated and enraged white suburbanites in the 60s accelerated. The underlying racial order, codified by redlining and mass incarceration, remained largely undisturbed, but the flow of culture, from television and movie portrayals to news media framing, resisted control by grassroots reactionaries. For the most part, these right-wingers were people who had grown secure in the waning days of the New Deal consensus era and lived lives of comfort and ease. But even when you're master of the land, you rage at your inability to control the tides.
Slick Willie style. After Reagan and his temporary replacement George H.W. shuffled out of office, the 1990s dawned as a decade of indiscriminate dudgeon at an indiscreet presidency and culture. The right hated Bill Clinton less for his policies, most of which were borrowed from the GOP, much as Nixon's were borrowed from his New Deal Congress, than for his status as an avatar of 1960s licentiousness. Pat Buchanan, the Hitler-sympathizing reactionary who held George H.W. Bush to 53% of the vote in the New Hampshire primary by railing against sodomy, Jewish pressure, women in the workplace, and African immigration, gave away the game in his primetime culture war speech to the 1992 Republican National Convention. "This, my friends, is radical feminism, the agenda that Clinton and Clinton would impose on America. Abortion on demand, a litmus test for the Supreme Court, homosexual rights, discrimination against religious schools, women in combat units, that's change all right, but it's not the kind of change that America needs. It is not the kind of change America wants, and it is not the kind of change we can abide in a nation that we still call God's country." Footnote, Pat Buchanan, quoted by the Washington Post, February 29, 1992, "I think God made all people good. But if we had to take a million immigrants in, say, Zulus next year, or Englishmen, and put them in Virginia, what group would be easier to assimilate and would cause less problems for the people of Virginia?" In the 28 days later red-pupiled eyes of the right, Clinton was a flag-burning, pot-smoking, USSR-visiting philanderer who, with his cookie-hating lawyer wife by his side, clambered over a heap of dead Arkansasoyers to steal the White House with just 43% of the vote. One didn't have to be a sovereign citizen under the unfridged flag of Ruby Ridge to divine that Slick Willie was an illegitimate president. For all of his third-wayism, Clinton did undo Reagan-Bush abortion restrictions, let closeted gays serve in the military, and sign an assault weapons bill that took everyone's dang guns away. With no major economic policy differences between Clintonite pragmatism and GOP orthodoxy, while the former at least accepted a social safety net, both supported NAFTA, the line item veto, and prioritizing deficit reduction, culture war issues and latent racial animus became more salient priorities to voters. After all, one party was promising to put an end to the daily baby Holocaust and throw Cadillac-driving welfare queens in prison, while the other was offering James Carville garbled bromides about fiscal responsibility and investing in opportunity. Team Clinton's feeble attempts to find middle ground with reactionary suburbanites, decrying black super predators and sister soldier, proved unsuccessful in withstanding the electoral tidal wave propelled by the burgeoning populist right. In 1994, Newt Gingrich intertubed that wave of resentment straight into the speaker's chair. Joining Newt's Republican Revolution were such solons as Bob Dornan, who had recently outed a gay colleague and told a reporter that, quote, "every lesbian spear chucker in the country is hoping I get defeated," and Colonel Ollie North, who had committed some light treason by selling weapons to Iran and raising over $20 million from direct mail solicitations, an early form of Kickstarter, to GOP grassrooters in his losing Senate bid. This new Republican Congress set about dismantling welfare, shutting down the government, and banning third trimester abortions. But the anti-establishment fervor of right-wing voters, stoked by feminazi-hating outsiders like Rush Limbaugh, who was feted as a majority maker and made an honorary member of the class of 94, was hardly sated by Newt's modest changes to congressional process. In 1996, Pat Buchanan was back, baby. This time wielding a literal pitchfork to continue his peasant revolt against Washington, D.C., which he thought was once a nice southern town, quote, "before all that crowd, black people, came rolling in and took it over." Despite a brief stint as frontrunner, Buchanan lost the nomination. Yet the old-style racial resentment at the amorphous D.C. establishment articulated by his campaign continued to metastasize. Buchanan later abandoned the GOP, announcing, "Neither Beltway Party is going to drain this swamp." but his brigades of aggrieved white suburbanites stayed, placated for the time being by the siren song of compassionate conservatism and a glibly pious cowboy LARPer from Texas. Bush was right. Based on the trajectory of his domestic agenda, George W. Bush was destined to be a one-term president. He inherited the dot-com bust, a recession, and a massive corporate accounting scandal. His priorities were a tax cut for the rich and a bipartisan bill with Ted Chappaquiddick Kennedy to inject the feds into public education. Sure, the frothing populist base got some weak sauce pandering with stem cells and faith-based bullshit. But with Clinton and his blowjob crimes receding in the rearview mirror, the grand old coalition of big business and lunkheads seemed destined to fracture. If only there was some sort of banner, or perhaps flag, they could all rally around. The 9/11 attacks finally gave the ambient cultural grievances of grassroots conservatism direction, focus, and energy. The global war on terror became a fighting faith for the 21st century. This particular American combination of Protestant wrath and militarized nationalism unleashed itself on the world, and woe betide any Arab or Frenchman who got in its way. The invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan were blood rituals, sacrifices to a god who embodied a pure retro vision of America in which the cultural pollutants of feminism, secularism, and multiculturalism were purged with fire. And no petty class grievances could ever disunify the GOP base. So engaged were they in the holy quest that gave new meaning to their lives. For an on-the-ground view of the populist right during the Bush years, here's a first-person report from our own Matt Christman.
Sometime after the invasion of Iraq, I worked in the bursar's office of a public university in the Midwest. I spent my days typing up labels for files and updating student information in an open bullpen. I was accompanied by a few sounds, the piped-in nursing home music of the local smooth jazz station, and, from the office behind me, the soft murmuring of local right-wing talk radio and the wrenching, wheezing cough of the man inside. His name was Neil, and he was a thin, balding man with glasses and a failing mustache. His job was to badger students who were delinquent on their loan payments. Otherwise, he listened to local talk radio shitheads and coughed. One day, I came into work, and his office was empty. My boss told me that Neil was dead and that I should clean out his desk. There wasn't much in there besides a travel-sized cologne bottle and some hard candy. The only other personal touch in the office was an editorial cartoon that Neil had cut out and pinned to his corkboard, depicting Uncle Sam standing on the deck of an aircraft carrier next to a row of fighter jets. He said, "Can Saddam come out and play?" This man had spent the last years of his life slowly suffocating and being yelled at by broke college students, his only source of pleasure and purpose coming from his imagined connection to the violent triumphs of the American military. Ever since then, I think of Neil whenever I contemplate the relentless militarized nightmare of the war on terror. At the grassroots level, support for obscene military spending and imperial bloodletting satisfies a deep psychic need among neutered and demoralized American men. I ate the dead man's candy and threw the rest of his shit out.
Jingoism, fear, and explicit homophobia propelled the Republicans to an electoral high watermark in 2004. As of this writing, the only time since the 1980s that they won the presidential popular vote. But despite the bodies piling up in Iraq and the yellow ribbon magnets plating entire car bumpers, those ancient tensions, people versus establishment, slobs versus snobs, plucky poor kid summer camp versus posh rich kid summer camp, began to rise from their slumber. White suburban boomers were aging and getting ornerier, growing ever more concerned about the proximity of millennials to their lawn. Despite whatever liberalizing drugs they consumed in the 1960s, they were now being fed a steady diet of unadulterated rage from scaremongering local TV news, AM talk radio, Fox News, crypto-fascist publishing grifters, FreeRepublic.com, chain emails from Bill Cosby warning of the looming saggy pants crisis, and the nascent right-wing blogosphere. It gave them a junkie's craving for something harder than Bill Frist or Roy Blunt. And soon the slumbering worm revealed itself. Bush's clumsy second-term attempt to privatize Social Security may have pissed off the AARP, but what really raised the hackles of the GOP base was Shamnesty, the bipartisan bill to beef up border security, revise guest worker visas, and offer a grueling path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. Not even such seasoned statesmen as Lindsey Graham and John McCain could sell a Kennedy co-sponsored bill to their apoplectic ward healers, who drew a line in the desert over letting brown people become legal residents. The rancor spilled over into the 2008 primaries, in which the right wing viewed McCain with suspicion or hostility for the immigration bill and his bleeding heart opposition to using medieval torture techniques on Muslims. To placate the grunts, he ran on generic country-first militarism, highlighting all the villages he napalmed in Indochina to distract from the fact that this privileged son of an admiral wasn't exactly a chud himself. When that didn't cut it, he chose, in a desperate act with far-reaching consequences, to elevate one of their ranks to the ticket. Sarah Palin, a certified brain genius who has read every newspaper, awakened a primal urge in the populist right. She proved that one of their own could stand on the national stage spewing verbal diarrhea and, quite possibly, if not for the machinations of the biased lib media, end up a heartbeat away from the presidency. Not coincidentally, McCain's rallies in the home stretch devolved into screams of terrorist and liar and jeers at their own candidates' feeble calls for civility. One rally full of Minnesota nice conservatives featured a man cryptically telling McCain, "Obama will lead this country to socialism. The time has come and the Bible tells us, you speak the truth and the truth sets you free." Another woman told him, "I can't trust Obama. I have read about him and he's an Arab." To which McCain responded, "Dear God, no, trust me. He's not an Arab. He's a normal person, I promise." Dog days of Obama. Then the gay Muslim Marxist canine eater won. America, Reagan's shining city on the hill, vanished in a cloud of chum smoke. Obama spent 4 years crumping on the Constitution, and real Americans had to just sit back and take it. Take it they did, but not well. Almost as soon as Obama was inaugurated, the country's reserve population of cranks, gunfuckers, and Revolutionary War cosplayers strapped teabags to their tricorn hats and staged armed occupations of JCPenney parking lots from coast to coast. They watched Fox News with the reverent intensity of an astronomer witnessing the explosion of a supernova. They forwarded emails about secret mosques in the White House basement and Facebook memes demanding to see Obama's birth certificate. Such an awful and alien being simply could not be a real American. He had to have hatched from a glistening black egg in a sun-cursed Kenyan village, then slouched towards Washington, D.C. in the dark of night. For the right, the only psychic bomb of those years was bearing witness to Obama's relentless parade of scandals, frauds, outrages, and humiliations, all of which ensured that he would go down in history as a Carter-esque failure who would keep Democrats out of any national power for a generation.
Then he won again. Despite 4 years of craven appeasement and bowing and telepromptering and 57 statesing and being from Kenya and Fast and Furious movies and letting our operators die at Benghazi and lying about keeping my doctor and killing that fly and latte saluting and putting his feet up and Acorn and Candy Crowley, dead and illegal voters, somehow snuck that Muslim Brotherhood sleeper agent back into the White House. No more White House. More like Black House. Black is his heart. Blacker and blacker and blacker into the depths of hell where no light reaches. Lost in darkness forever. The names of demons in the air, wrapped like a hip-hop barbecue. Tan suit, tan as the skin of a lost and beaten ambassador. Bent at the knee, sorry, so sorry, so sorry for my evil white country. Logic and proportion fallen sloppy dead. No more, no more than Hillary. Witch's Sabbath out, damn spot. Vince Foster in moonlight. No hope, a lesser bush. Milk-white soul, milk-white blood. Please clap, rhinoceros grazing in blank impotence. What is this? The sound of thunder, the rumble of horse hooves, the flowing blonde mane buffeted by wind, sword in hand, shield in hand, crimson billed crown atop his head, fired, Obama fired, Hillary fired, America made great again, the glorious wealth, orange, silken triumph, golden victory, the finest, the finest, the finest, perfect lips, perfect mouth, sneer of cold command, apprentice to Christ, commander of righteousness, lock her up, French-Canadian bean soup, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, a rose pushing through corpses, fake news, real victory, real cleansing, the wall, the wall, the wall, oh mama, please don't tear, don't rip, jobs, 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 yes, I said, yes, I will, MAGA, 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 are you triggered, are you triggered, are you triggered, are you triggered, are you triggered? 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 Are you triggered?
Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Are you triggered? Ah, few a mother's boy has never wept nor dashed 1,000 Kim triggered, Carpo triggered, Carpo.
Schizopolis. Their brains broken by the cognitive dissonance of worshipping a country governed by someone who represented everything they fear and loathe, American right-wingers completely snapped and embraced the nihilistic spectacle of President Donald Trump. Much ink has since been dedicated to the question, why? Here's a couple of drops. Because Trump does to liberals and minorities exactly what they thought Obama did to conservatives. Politics has become a realm of purely spiteful grievance. The only way out of this state of gibbering resentment is a positive vision, one that reconciles the concept of, quote, America, which right-wingers hold sacred, and the fetid reality of multiculturalism and moral decay they see all around them. This vision is currently the one being promoted by the nascent white nationalist movement, which recognizes that the only way for America to conform to the glittering homeland they see in their heads is for the minorities and leftists and liberals and, triple parentheses, media types, to be driven from the land. Only then, in a country refounded on blood and soil, will the Starbucks barista write, quote, cool dude on your cup without rolling her eyes. Remember, and remember well, that anyone who tries to feed you a line about how Donald Trump is not a, quote, real conservative is absolutely full of shit or is trying to sell you the next big lie. Trump represents everything that this vicious and corrupt project has valorized and promoted for the last 40 years. And what's more, the disasters of right-wing governance have created a country exactly as stupid and desperate as the one that actually elected a buffoon like him. The problem Trump now presents for the conservative intelligentsia is that he's simply too much like the hogs who have been lapping up the slop of conservative ideology for decades, and not enough like the undead ghouls who have been ladling it out. Since he has absolutely no intellectual foundation, he lacks initiation in the rites, rituals, and codes that have allowed previous conservatives to present themselves as thoughtful. So strap in, folks. This is only the beginning. Trump himself, with his Heritage Foundation brain trust and Goldman Sachs cabinet, may look like a cream puff compared to the next generation of Republican demagogues who take the bloodthirsty, nativist, white power ideology far more seriously.
Taxonomies. Bowtie dipshit. You remember the kid who carried a briefcase to school since he was 11? He grew up into this creature. A very specific subset of right-wing anti-intellectual intellectual, the bowtie dipshit represents the upper crust of the conservative movement. Loathed by his peers from college and beyond for reminding teachers that they've forgotten to assign homework and for reporting his roommate to the FBI for having sex, a robust hatred of academia nevertheless courses through every molecule of bowtie dipshit's body. That body can currently be found enjoying lifetime tenure at Stanford's Hoover Institution or George Mason University's Mercatus Center. Indeed, valorizing the pastimes and tastes of the conservative base is the main function of the bowtie dipshit. Where your average dipshit rube yelled, "Shut up and play," at the Dixie Chicks in 2003, the bowtie dipshit channeled his everyman populist rage into a 3,000-word piece for his vanity project, The Clarion Criterion, about how the conductor of the New York Philharmonic attacked him personally by calling George W. Bush an ignoramus. This results in endless books, articles, and quotes cribbed from Thucydides about why NASCAR, hunting, smoking cigarettes, driving a $100,000 pickup, eating hog fat, etc., is the culturally and philosophically correct pastime as opposed to the frivolous and elitist hobbies, drinking wine, drinking coffee, sodomy, of the coastal types that bowtie dipshit spends all his time around. His back catalog includes Sell Your Child and Save, A Guide to Austrian Economics, Baseball, The Most Beauteous Sport, Modern Pericles, Why George W. Bush Will Join the Pantheon of Classical Heroes. His favorite colors are periwinkle, mauve, chartreuse, and seersucker.
YouTube logic guy. This species is a hybrid synthesized from several pre-existing ones. The message board atheist, libertarian logical fallacy man, and the age of consent warrior all existed as separate entities in the earlier days of the internet. Times when different types of people were cordoned off in different web rings that unified like-minded peoples. But ever since the vast online worlds merged into a few main social networks, these previously distinct species began to interbreed, chiefly to take on the incursion of disruptive, illogical species into their shared space. From their asexual reproductive methods emerged YouTube Logic Guy. Platforms like Facebook and Twitter were somewhat hospitable to this mutated progeny, but Twitter's character limits imposed ceilings on the level of genius he was allowed to dispense at one time, while Facebook's insistence on using real names prohibited the bravest soldiers of truth from employing all the weapons in their arsenal. It was not until YouTube was discovered that they could settle into an ecosystem that truly nurtured their biology, a platform that allowed them to stare directly into a webcam and talk about how Miracle on 34th Street misinforms children that it's okay to not use reason for 3 hours at a time. While YouTube Logic Guy's deformities, such as unearned intellectualism and obsession with boring-ass books that suck shit, may confuse the untrained into thinking he's just an energy drink-swilling variant of the bowtie dipshit, he is vastly different. While the bowtie dipshit loves long-dead European authors, YouTube Logic Guy likes only one deado, Christopher Hitchens, and usually defers to living writers such as Sam Harris and Game Master Anthony. Top videos on YouTube Logic Guy's channel. Golden Retriever gets owned for violating NAP. Monkey Bars, Kangaroo Court. My unlawful ejection from the playground. Lapban rants. Sarkeesian destroyed. SJW doctors botch Logic Guy's gastric bypass RIP tribute video.
Oligarch Monopoly Man. These are the guys who actually stand to benefit from all the atavistic racism, mindless resentment, and puerile spectacle commodified and propagated by the other people on this list. Every time an alt-right grifter periscopes himself owning SJW college students, or Fox News reports that the United Nations is using your tax dollars to breed a new type of super-Muslim, or your uncle ruins Thanksgiving dinner by shooting your biracial cousin with a crossbow, Oligarch Monopoly Man gets a percentage point knocked off his tax liability. He's a man of absurd wealth, likely gained through the hard work of his Nazi collaborating father or slave trading great-grandfather, and he wants to keep it. All of it. His plan for doing so involves sprinkling dark money over every perverse reactionary media project and politician he can find, while he cosplays as a salt-of-the-earth cowboy who definitely knows how to ride a horse. As America sinks further into mutual acrimony and paranoia, Oligarch Monopoly Man stacks that cash. Teen blood transfusions, cryo chambers, and mech suits don't come cheap. And it costs a lot of money to build a perfect replica of the set of the Jean-Claude Van Damme film Hard Target to be stocked with the most dangerous game of all, man. But the most important reason it's worth destroying the Earth to hold on to your precious lucre is as simple as it is expensive. Immortality. Most Oligarch Monopoly Men achieve immortality the old-fashioned way, by leaving a vast financial empire to their half-wit children, who promptly contract syphilis and blow the whole fortune on prosthetic dicks. Ideological nonconformity. Family built oil pipelines and infrastructure for Hitler and Stalin. Percentage of America's wealth currently being hoarded, 20 to 30. Right-wing think tanks and magazines currently funding, all of them.
Neocon cuck. The first examples of these organisms showed up in Ivy/sub-Ivy institutions as young Trotskyist tadpoles, their heads filled with the worst affectations of upper-middle-class intellectuals. But upon entering Leo Strauss's University of Chicago, each and every one mutated into a large, disgusting frog whose genetic purpose was to remake the world. These bowling pin-shaped jackoffs matriculated into the Departments of State and Defense and declared themselves to be Russia experts as part of a Ford-era intelligence shop called Team Beta, which analyzed Russia and came up with reasons to arm what would eventually become Al-Qaeda. After some mysterious violent group these guys had nothing to do with brought down the Twin Towers, these sons of CIA-funded academics had a golden opportunity to utilize the nativist rage and bloodlust of bumpkins and middle-class authoritarians alike to kick off the virtuous wars the philosopher kings had wanted for years. The neocon cucks helped us dive dick-first into Afghanistan and Iraq. Trump was the best thing that could have ever happened to them. He lacks the veneer of propriety these sleazes need to remain friends with equally repellent liberal elites, As a result, many neocon cucks have been heralded as valorous, patriotic conservatives, welcomed into the hashtag resistance, and rewarded with cushy gigs as op-ed columnists in respectable liberal media outlets. It doesn't matter that they stoke the same racist impulses Trump did to get their wars. The fact that they want the same norms is enough for people. Greatest asset, being the nephew of someone important. Work history. Opening letters for father. Answering phones for daddy. Showing papa how to use the computer. Editing articles for the old man after dementia slows the old workhorse down. Defending the captain after his seminal piece, The Problem with Negroes, becomes public knowledge again. Serving as editor-in-chief of Commentary and or the Weekly Standard.
Liberty Babe. She's conservative, she's traditional, and she's hot. Auga! It's Liberty Babe, a conservative media personality who appeals to an audience of mostly Social Security age men hungry for books that reinforce their cosseted worldview and whose jackets give their lonely trouser worms a jolt of life. After her best-selling screeds Betrayed, Mugged, and Defiled, her latest release, Gangbanged, How Weak Rhinos and the Loony Left Are Spit-Roasting America, is lighting up the Daily Caller comments section. She's a lady, but she also watches football, drinks bourbon, and can field dress a buck. She may not write her own books, but Liberty Babe will passionately defend their ideas against the limp-wristed, liberal pajama boys Fox News keeps refrigerated in the green room. Also, sorry haters, she doesn't have time for turncoat colleagues who have sullied the memory of Chairman Roger Ailes and accused him of depraved sexual abuse. She knows doing a twirl for the lecherous 80-year-old hemophiliac while he bleeds through his pants is simply the price of entry into the boys' club. But just in case public sentiment does turn against the Fox conglomerate, she's got her own show, Muzzle Flash, on the NRA's digital-only channel. Each episode features her shooting a liberal in the back of the head and lighting his body on fire while the sprinkler system goes off, getting everyone's tops a little moist as Liberty Babe goes off on a viral pro-gun rant. She signs off by shooting another liberal in the head and making out with his widow. Catchphrases. Quote, gentlemen prefer guns. And, quote, greenhouse gases get me hot. Upcoming book. Dirty Sanchez, The Left's Plan to Turn America Gay and Mexican.
Daughter Defender. It's no secret that the American institution of fatherhood is under attack from activist family court judges, sex perverts, and ISIS-style immigrants. While most allow this institution to shrivel away like so many manhoods, there are a few brave vanguards in the American suburbs who act as Knights Templar to fellow dads. They prefer garish clothing replete with shiny angel wings and words like loyalty, but their most holy garments are shirts that outline rules for dating their daughters. Yes, these men oppose foreign appeasement and gender tyranny, but their biggest fear is the sexuality of their baby girls. The daughter defenders every moment is spent fantasizing about a murky sicko, be they terrorist, Black Lives Matter thug, or boy in the wrong type of bucket hat, harming his daughter, allowing him to put his weekend martial arts training into practice. We can safely surmise that, for all the daughter defenders' outward masculinity, this brick of unreleased rage and violence wishes he were his daughter. Rules for dating the daughter. 1. Get a job. 2. Pull up your pants. 3. Realize I'm watching you. 4. You kiss her, I kiss you. 5. Have her at my front door at 9, be in my tool shed at 9:30. 6. Take pictures of your muscles and send them to me. 7. Know that you are sexting both of us. 8. Know that I'm a former high school wrestling coach. 9. I don't mind going back to jail for child pornography. 10. It may be her first time, but it's not mine. Citizen Keck. A few hundred years ago, the socially dislocated middle-class male could ship off to one of his nation's colonies and transform from virginal caterpillar to steely-eyed butterfly after successfully killing another man. With more and more fucked-up isolated young men in the middle class, but fewer colonies to send them to, the options for these people are dwindling. Sure, there's ISIS, but in the West, we have something else. No, it's not our military. The military is where you go when you really need a communications degree and you've accepted the risk of dying and killing for it. Besides, you have to run and spend time away from your computer. For those who are truly dissociated from modern life, there is the alt-right. Citizen Keck is inspired by great heroes of Christendom like Charles Martel, Constantine, Christopher Nolan's Batman, and the Doom Marine. Like his ISIS equivalent, he's repulsed by pluralism, sexuality, and alienation of modern life. However, unlike his heathen counterpart, his ideology is centered on saving the West. His sworn enemies are, in total, Islam, the left, liberals, cereal companies, the video game industry, and women with short hair. Brought into the fold of neo-fascism through some combination of thwarted pickup artist ambition, being banned from a video game forum, and mom dating Steve again, Citizen Keck now loves doing ironic meta-comedy about how the Holocaust was good, because to him, the strong exterminating useless subhuman people is extra ironic. In addition to his extremely funny admiration for Hitler, Citizen Keck is obsessed with declining white birth rates in the West and finding a way he can fight back against this trend. Top alt-right Twitter handles: Neo-reactionary Grimace, Hemorrhoidal Saxon, Reinhard Drydick. Top alt-right hashtags: Deus Volt, White Genocide, Cuck Mom, Ma Allowance, Incel Rebellion. Tradcath Weirdo. A relatively new subset of religious hysteric, the Tradcath Weirdo is a blazer-clad nebbish who imagines himself to be a craggy but lovable character in a Kingsley Amis or P.G. Woodhouse novel, and cosplays to match. The result is a lot of tweed jackets, pipes, and upsetting facial hair, with none of the good humor or charm that usually accompanies them. It's normal for reactionaries to rage against the modern world, but it's not as commonplace to encounter the esoteric affectations and pitchfork.com-like criticisms that the Tradcath Weirdo will expound through scotch-ache breath. Imagine a Wes Anderson character, but with the cool New Order song accompanying their entrance replaced by a Gregorian chant they self-flagellate to for 45 minutes after seeing a particularly raunchy Two Broke Girls subway ad. Unlike many of his brethren on the right, the Tradcath Weirdo will often seek to distinguish himself by correctly identifying the horrors of capitalism. Unfortunately, his prescriptions for these problems are to bring back Latin mass and purge skirts with above-the-knee hemlines from network TV. Instead of directing his ire towards financial capital or duplicitous public servants, his psychic energy churns with Lovecraftian disgust and horror at childless couples. In fact, the Tradcath Weirdo is so obsessed with fecundity and non-procreating marriages that he represents the only type of contemporary white person that actively hates dogs. Twee affectations: walking stick, cane, shillelagh, sitting stick, sleeping staff, shower cane. Tightest fit: blazer made entirely of elbow patches, sleeveless cardigan vest made of badger hair, quadruple pleated trousers, Gucci flip-flops. Over under on time before next religious conversion experience: 6 months.
Meemaw and Pet-Pet. We hesitate to generalize our audience, much less all Americans, but this is literally your grandparents. They come from an era when people had the common decency to say, "Sir, ma'am," and, "Boy, that's not the water fountain you're supposed to use." Somewhere along the line, some member of your family fucked up and showed them how to use the computer. After that, Meemaw and Pep-Pep were no longer limited to Fox News' daytime hit, Skirts and Suits, Heartland Headlines. They became privy to thousands of websites and chain emails, all racing through Pep-Pep's dementia to see which one implodes his brain before the light finally goes out. When you go to their house, Meemaw and Pep-Pep have copies of books like Masquerade, How Your Kid's Magnet School Became a Madrasa, by Liberty Babe Tresta Cranberry on their shelves. Their eyes seem to imply that they've already run through their brain's allotment of deathbed DMT. Despite the fact that their spines are shaped like ampersands, and every moment loosens their grasp on reality, Meemaw and Pep-Pep always vote. They vote more than anyone you've ever known. Wonder how we now have 300 congresspeople who ran on ending the Muslim Brotherhood infiltration of Panera Bread? Look at Meemaw and Pep-Pep hobbling down to the polling place, rain, sleet, or shine. Some of their most recent forwarded chain emails include: West Indian home care nurse stealing from me, UN Agenda 21 seizing rascal scooters, Bill Cosby tells it like it is, and Bible code revealed, winning bingo numbers. Mima and Pep-Pep's last conscious thought before death is, when will my Sean Hannity commemorative coins arrive?
Actual vampire. Right-wingers continue to lionize decades and even centuries past, but how many of them actually lived through those times? The conservative movement is filled with boys who look like old men, and old men who look like condoms packed with oatmeal. But astride them all are a proud few creatures of the night, who technically died before the Reformation, but show no signs of wear and tear. Legend has it that vampires first appeared in early 15th century Romania, when a nobleman investigating Turkish no-go zones in the countryside attempted to use alchemy in order to protect himself from knockout gangs loyal to Mehmet I. Unfortunately for him, but fortunately for all lovers of debate and intellect, the nobleman was transformed into a horrible creature that could never die. This impossibly old and wicked monster came from a time before safe spaces, and will probably use his hypnotic powers to get you to kill a family member, as that's the only kind of thing that entertains him anymore. The actual vampire is so committed to old-fashioned manners that he will not enter a domicile unless he is specifically invited. While his clothing choices, mostly capes and cassocks, reveal a traditional sensibility, he is committed to the cool, urbane nightlife activities typical of an intellectual conservative. These bon vivants are known to levitate caddishly outside the windows of young men and women, and hold rousing debates on the death tax. While they're usually considered to be of Eastern European origin, actual vampires now make their homes in the sub-basements of brainy conservative institutions like the National Review and the Heritage Foundation. Special abilities. Can transform into a bat. Cast no reflection in mirrors. Immortality. Weaknesses. Sunlight. Garlic. Crucifixes. Holy water. Wooden stake through the heart. Housing court judge.
Chapter 4. Media. Take away the newspaper, and this country of ours would become a scene of chaos. Without daily assurance of the exact facts, so far as we are able to know and publish them, the public imagination would run riot. 10 days without the daily newspaper and the strong pressure of worry and fear would throw the people of this country into mob hysteria, feeding upon rumors, alarms, terrified by bugbears and illusions. We have become the watchmen of the night and of a troubled day. Harry Chandler. R.I.P. My Menchies. @Vox_Michael. Extry, extry, read all about it. Daring dirtbags disrupt Daffy Democrats' discombobulated discourse. That's how this chapter might have read if we still lived in the ink-stained era of print news. Today, however, virtually all Americans get their news, opinions, and pornography through the internet. How did we get from dead logs to live blogs, from editorial boards to circuit boards? Put on your newsboy cap and read on, because Chapo Trap House has the scoop. Sir, Have You No Shame, Sir. A History of Journalism. The first mass-produced newspapers emerged in Germany shortly after the invention of the printing press. They included Relation à la Vernehmen und Gedenkwürdigen Historien, account of all distinguished and commemorable news, and Liste der bekannten Juden, list of known Jews. These publications disseminated vital information about current affairs to the literate masses. The concept spread to London, where gazetteers on Fleet Street added such innovations as editorials and the page three slags. Across the Atlantic, a media culture flourished in the 13 colonies, where the issues of the day were hotly debated within the pages of newsletters and pamphlets. Among the early commentators was a young publisher's apprentice named Benjamin Franklin. He was a polymath and the first true American man of letters, in that he generated reams and reams of extremely horny correspondence. As a sexual degenerate who disseminated totally useless advice to the ignorant masses, sample aphorism, the fool wakes up to the cuckoo's crow, whilst the wise man rises to the songbird of reason. Ben Franklin was also our nation's first pundit. Out of the colonist pamphleteering culture emerged an uncompromising devotion to freedom of speech, which produced such widely read radical polemics as Common Sense and No Taxation Without Fringeless Flags. After the Revolution, ratification of the proposed U.S. Constitution was hotly debated through competing serials such as the Federalist Papers and the vastly more popular, Wow, I Had No Idea About These 10 Bills of Rights, number 6 will shock you. American journalism in the first part of the 19th century consisted mostly of libelous attacks on politicians' illegitimate octoroon children, classified ads for bounties on escaped slaves, and advice columns. Newspapers tended to be partisan outlets loyal to single-issue parties like the anti-